comfort zone. It's a well-known phrase in sales. Guy gets some money, makes a few deals. All of a sudden, you know, selling is not high on the agenda anymore. Why is that? Well, initially, you know, you're under a lot of duress. You need money to pay the bills. You're only as good as your last deal, especially if you're commission only. So every month you start over. So initially, you know, you need some money. So you work. If you don't make enough sales, you'll actually experience some duress. Of course, if you work really hard, you also experience duress, because work is called work for a reason. It's easier to mess around and take time off and play video games, go to the beach, whatever you want to do. That's fun. Work isn't, for most of us. So you're kind of like in between this little zone between pain if I don't do anything, but as soon as I start doing things, I'm also in pain. Which pain is worse? People take the path of least resistance. In other words, they'll go in a direction where they're opposed by the least amount of force. If they don't do any work, they're under a lot of duress because they might get evicted. They can't go to restaurants. Might not be able to make their car payment, get their car, you know, sooner or later bad things start happening. And if they work real hard, that's probably not as bad. So they'll find that middle ground in there. And that's what they call about the comfort zone. That's the zone that they're in, the zone where they're kind of doing just enough to get by, but not too much to actually have to work really hard. Just enough to get by. So is that good or bad? Oh, let's examine it. What's good or bad mean? Do we have to make a value judgment on this? There was a famous American psychologist named Abraham Maslow who was practicing mainly in the mid-1990s. He's well known for his Maslow hierarchy of needs, which looks like a pyramid. And on the bottom are the base needs, like physical needs. You need air and water and food. Right above that is safety against any kind of danger, physical danger and threats. If I cut off your air, you're not really worried about the possibility of a lion attack, are you? It's a little bit more pressing need. And there are certain social needs because we're social animals, so it's really hard to be excluded from the group or to be isolated. People put in solitary confinement can literally go crazy in jail to be isolated like that. Then there's certain self-esteem needs. Everybody wants to think that they're valuable, that they have worth, that they're worthy of respect. And once these needs are, you know, up to going up this hierarchy, then you come to, you know, more abstract self-actualization, developing your potential, artistic, you know, achievements, that type of thing. You're not really worried about that next painting if you haven't eaten in a week. That's why people in third world countries will, you know, they'll cut down the forest if they have to if they're starving. They don't have time to worry about it. You have to have a certain level of income before you start worrying about the ecology. It's more of an abstract thing you're looking at. The motivating force is actually stronger near the base. Physical needs are much stronger than social needs. And the higher the need in the pyramid, the weaker and more distinctly human it is. The lower needs are actually shared by other animals. There's not that many animals that have a real need for an aesthetic sense to create art, say. That doesn't exist too much in the animal kingdom. So let's look at that comfort zone again. What would be the rational thing to do? What's the rational behavior? What's in your best interest? Well, I would propose to you that it's in your best interest to do just the bare minimum to get by. That's the most rational behavior. Let's say you're on an island. It's covered with a wide variety of strange plants that you've never seen before. There's no animals. And you're trapped there, you're shipwrecked. And gradually, you need shelter, you need water, and you're going to need food sooner or later. So let's say you've managed to get yourself out of the direct sunlight and out of some basic shelter, and you got water. And now you're slowly starving to death. You need food. You look around you, and there's all these plants. Now, that plant, that was pretty good, that plant, especially after a week without eating, you know. And why do you wait a week? Because you're afraid that plant might be poisonous. You don't know what that plant's going to do to you if you eat it. But sooner or later, you're going to have to take a chance. You're either going to have to starve to death or eat a plant. So let's say, you know, you just take, you know, you take your best guess, and there's a plant there, and it turns out to not kill you. Actually, it's pretty good. So now, you're eating. You're not going to starve. You got a plant to eat. And there's enough of them around. You can eat that one for probably a good long time. There's so many. It's just you on a big island. You can eat that plant for years, and it's not going to, you know, those keep regenerating. But after a while, you may not be getting the full nutritional balance you need off of just one plant. Matter of fact, you can pretty much assume you're not. So you have a risk of long-term, like scurvy or some other vitamin deficiency disease. And it'd probably be a really good idea for you to balance your diet out a little bit. And maybe not, but you're really bored with this, you know, guava thing or whatever you're eating. Matter of fact, after a while, it's going to start driving you crazy. You can't even stand looking at the thing anymore. So now you're going to eat another plant. You want to do, you know, pick another plant. You want to take a chance. Now, you could die and lose everything. The first plant you ate had an infinite utility value to you. You could take the risk because you're going to die anyway. But what is the return on your investment and the risk-reward ratio for that second plant? That second plant, you may die. Or you may gain a less of a benefit, lesser of a benefit, more marginal. And that, yes, you may prevent some long-term vitamin deficiencies, and it'll be a lot better, you know, a lot more fun to have a second plant to eat, less boring. Are you going to eat that second plant? What does common sense tell you? Anybody want to respond to that?
Don't eat it.
You'd be better off. Maybe you think you could still get rescued, right? Instead of, they're going to find you dead because the second plant killed you. Let's say you do it anyway, you ate it. So you have a slightly better resistance now to vitamin deficiency diseases, and you're a little bit better nourished. You have a little bit more of a balanced diet. And it's a little bit more interesting to, you know, you can combine those plants in different ways. And then another month goes by, and you're thinking, man, that second plant was pretty good. I wonder what this other one tastes like. Do you eat the third one? I'll answer the question. One of your ancestors did. Every plant that we know, someone had to eat it first, okay? And you know how you work at that one, don't you? You capture a slave and make the slave eat it. Make it a crime. Someone's committed a crime, make him eat the plant. So anyway, you eat the third plant. The fourth, diminishing returns almost looks like it almost falls off a cliff as far as the reward you get for the risk you're taking. You're taking the same risk each time, life or death. Only for a smaller, marginally incremental benefit. This is analogous to the situation of a commission rep. How many more hours should I spend working? Theoretically, I can work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, forever. Theoretically. There are people, by the way, who actually can go without sleep. It's very rare. If you try to do that, you get sick, really sick. You'd be in bad shape. But you can work 20 hours a day, 7 days a week. People do it. I mean, there's people who work 10, 12 hours a day, 6, 7 days a week, right? Yeah. Well, how many hours do you work for what gain? I guess, you know, that's what I'm saying. Some people, a comfort zone is kind of a flexible thing, right? You can work too little, you can work too many. What most people tend to do is they have a certain standard of life they want to maintain. And if they can get that, they're happy. That's why most people are perfectly happy taking a salary job. They simply reduce their expectations to suit. They do the minimum to get by, and they get what they want, and that's it. They go home. They work, you know, 9 to 5, and they screw around for 2 or 3 of those hours, take days off as many times as possible, take their salary, you know, share the rent, buy a cheap car, and they're good to go. Some people would say, oh, they're lazy. Wow, that's, you could say that. That's a value adjustment that you're placing on it. What you could say is that's exactly what almost everybody does if they get the chance. They will work the fewest possible hours because they really don't like their jobs anyway. They don't really derive much out of it. Most people like the social. They like being around people. They like having friends and being around people and not being in a house all day. That's why they say they like their jobs. Their jobs give them a way to get the hell out of the house, right? A woman has a lot of kids. Her house is dirty. Kids are crying. She's happy to get the heck out of the house, get a job. It's easier, actually. Anybody raise kids, you know what I'm talking about. It's harder to do that than it is just to work for most people. But, you know, as far as ambition goes and wanting things, it's not that important. They have, you know, once they achieve a certain standard of living and they're eating, you got a house. Okay. What do you need? Let's look at this situation. It's a cold winter evening in New Jersey. Your car broke down on the side of the highway, and you're walking because there's just no one around. Say it's a Sunday night on a holiday or something, there's just no one around. So you're walking 3 miles down to the next exit trying to find help. That's a long walk, isn't it? Or you can't afford a car, and you have to walk to your job, which is 5 miles away, bad weather again. The difference between walking and the cheapest piece of crap car you can possibly get, a piece of junk, smoking, ugly, rusted out, you know, nothing of a car. But you can get to work. Even if the heater doesn't work, has no radio, right? Has ball tires. But as long as it makes it to work, you're there in 5 minutes instead of an hour, 2 hour walk. There's a huge difference, utility value, between walking and that piece of junk car. Now, what is the difference between that piece of junk car and a brand new Ferrari or a Rolls Royce or a BMW or any other exotic car? Practically, what's the difference? I would propose that it's 99% is between walking and a piece of crap car and 1% after that. Would you guys agree with me?
Yep.
That's a classic example of diminishing returns. What's the difference between you're starving and you're being forced to eat at McDonald's, which to me would be like a fate worse than death. But then I live in Marin County, so that's how it goes. Disgusting, or even worse, Taco Bell, disgusting pre-processed factory food that's regurgitated and microwaved at the point of delivery. It's like Soylent Green. Ever watch that movie? Okay, so what's the difference between starving and having to eat a Taco Bell? Or Taco Bell to the finest five-star French restaurant in Paris, where you sit down to an 18-course meal cooked by one of the most world-famous chefs. Practically, the next morning when you go to the bathroom, I'm not trying to be gross here, but think about it. You've got your nutritional value out of the food, and you're no longer starving to death, correct? And even Taco Bells will keep you alive for a while. Not that you'd want to live, but you get my idea. All joking aside, what is the difference between starving to death and just garbage food, or from the garbage food to the best cuisine on the planet? Again, I'll say 99%, maybe 1%. Does everybody agree with me?
Yep.
How about a house? What do you really need as far as a house goes? Go outside, naked, in the north woods of Idaho. Right, Vermont? And I want to see how long you last out there. And then tell me the value of a log with some brush cover and a small little fire. Anything to get you into somewhere where you can conserve your physical warmth and not have hypothermia. That's life or death And yet, a mile away could be some guy's mansion. Central heat, air filtration, satellite TV, DVRs, you know, chef quality ranges in the kitchen, custom kitchens, Whirlpool tubs. He's very comfortable, right? And after about, if you lived in that mansion, after about a week or two, I guarantee you, it's just going to be another house. Yeah, I've seen the tiles. Yeah, I've seen the other. That's great. It's real nice evidence. It's built to last 5,000 years. It'll outlast the pyramids. Some of these ovens. They're made out of like 4-inch thick steel, like a battleship. Like you really need a stove built like that, right? For $20,000. All brass and stainless steel and all this other stuff. I mean, it's nice. Aesthetically, what it is art. It's not a cooking device anymore. It's a work of art. It's a cooking device if it's in a restaurant and it's in your house. You know what I'm saying? Unless you're running a bed and breakfast. It's art. It's overkill, isn't it? Again, so what's the difference between that primitive shelter which kept you alive and the fanciest house in the world, Steve? Well, I'd say 99% and 1%. What do you think?
Sounds about right.
Maybe 99.99%. The diminishing returns is the technical phrase. It's diminishing returns. Once you get to a certain point where you have what you need, anything beyond that is actually irrational behavior. Beyond the aesthetic enjoyment you get from having that custom home with the teak wood and the stained glass and all these toys and things in the artwork, you get a certain aesthetic appreciation. But if you go back to Maslow's hierarchy of needs, where are those aesthetic needs located? Towards the top of the stack, correct? And as we already said, the further away from the base you get, the less urgent those needs are. So all you're buying with that extra work and money is a little bit better aesthetic pleasure. How about if you had a dog? It's a mutt. You got it for free at the shelter. They even paid for the shots. And yet the dog is lovable. It gives you companionship. It's nice soft fur. You could play that dog. It doesn't cost you anything. Or you could have a big summer home up in Aspen that you really never see. Which actually gives you more value for your, you know, which actually brings you the most? That dog or that house you don't really use? That trophy house. So what happens is people literally act rationally. Even though you might think people are rational, they're not irrational. They're actually programmed. Your DNA is the sum total of knowledge and experience of all your ancestors is in there somewhere. In your DNA, you are literally programmed for risk aversity. Taking risks is a stupid thing to do for your survival. People who take risks tend to die, okay? Therefore, they don't get to reproduce. Therefore, natural selection occurs, and it takes that gene out of us. But on the other hand, when the environment changes around us, we are forced to adapt and change. And taking risk is a requirement to survive. Therefore, that risk-taking gene is in there, too. They're both in there, and they're at odds with each other. So a primitive society would decide not to take any risk, don't change anything, because that fourth plant may kill you. That's stupid. We have three, that's good enough. Leave it alone. Or 20, whatever you have, okay? Just leave it alone. Don't do anything else. On the other hand, what happens if the climate changes and those plants get wiped out? Guess what? You have to start. Now you have to look for that fifth plant, which now becomes your first plant. You have to do it all over again. And if there's no one willing to take a risk, then you'll die out that way. But if you take too many risks, you'll die out. So there's this balancing act, surprisingly like a comfort zone, isn't it? So what I'm saying is that all this stuff is programmed, so the seemingly irrational behavior, right, can be considered rational. The idea of doing the bare minimum to get by is supremely rational. It's supremely rational, because why should you kill yourself and get all stressed out working for stuff you don't need? You don't need it. There's a book called Voluntary Simplicity. Anybody ever hear that book?
Nope.
Voluntary Simplicity is like, you know, like a Buddhist kind of a thing where you don't attach. seek out wealth, you know, don't get attached to money. That whole kind of philosophical movements, religions. And actually, they're very rational because it is rational. Why would you seek more of something you can't take with you when you die anyway? You can only use it while you're alive. You're only alive for a short period of time. And you could spend your whole life trying to amass these things, only just to die anyway. And even worse, what happens if you fail to gain them? You spent your whole life lusting after money, trying to get it, and you don't even get it at the end. The only thing worse than that is getting it. And here's why that's the worst thing, because then you find out for a fact that you didn't need it in the first place, that it brings you nothing but more grief. And now your dream is gone on top of it, because the dream you had before, which sustained you, was this, when I get this money, I'll be happy. So now even that's gone. You're left with nothing. You've wasted your whole life seeking money. And when you find it, that's why rich people kill themselves. They hang themselves at the end because they're empty inside, and now they're faced with that reality. So the comfort zone. Oh, yeah, there's a comfort zone in sales. You know, they make enough money, then they stop selling. Okay, thanks, next. I mean, doesn't that over-trivialize the topic? There's a lot to this. Of course they do. Absolutely. It's abnormal to keep selling when you already have enough money for the month. So most people stop selling. As soon as they get enough money for the month, they quit. They go out and screw around. So where's so-and-so? He got a big deal. He took up. He's gone. Exactly. Exactly like they should, because he can go out and enjoy his life, spend time with his kids, take his wife out, you know, go bowling, have fun. That is rational. Being ambitious is irrational. And yet if it wasn't for ambitious people, we'd be dead. We wouldn't have explored the various continents and settled the earth and achieved what we've achieved that everybody benefits by. But if everybody did that, what would this planet look like if everybody was ambitious? It'd be scary. You have to think about that one for a while. The vast majority of people are not, and that's completely rational for them not to be ambitious. They should do exactly what they need just to get by and not a bit more, and then that's exactly what they do. What they'll do is maybe they'll enjoy the aesthetic and the social and other things off the Maslow's hierarchy. For some reason, I've always had a fascination with North American history, prehistory. I want to know about stuff before the books, before the kings and this guy and the politicians and the popes and all the rest of these guys. What was life like back then? What I discovered, when you go back and all the Bering Strait land bridge from Siberia to Alaska, blah, blah, they came over 30, 40, 50,000 years ago, blah, 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 and they dispersed throughout the whole of North America and South America. But what was really interesting is the Northwest. The Northwest was the best place to be. Had mild climate, didn't have a sharp winter, and everything just grows like weeds. The Indians who lived there were so rich that their hobby was they would spend like a year amassing deer skins and beaver pelts and otter and ivory, whatever they can get, just unbelievable amounts of wealth. And they threw a big party called a potlatch. And they invite the neighboring tribe over and the king, and they sit them down, and they just start piling stuff on them, one thing after another. They humiliate the hell of the guy, and they laugh at him. It wasn't that they liked the guy. This was their form of warfare. It was warfare by gift-giving. They were so wealthy, they had time to carve totem poles, while other Indians in the plains and everything else were basically, you know, getting by. That's because of natural wealth out there. They had salmon in the streams. They had shellfish in the oceans. They had just everything. Everything would grow. I mean, it's a rainforest. Stuff just grows there like nuts, trees, lumber. It's an amazing thing to behold. Compare that with Iceland and Greenland and a lot of other areas, so you'll know what I'm saying. These guys had it made. So here's what they found to do with all that wealth. They found a way to humiliate each other, and then the next guy would try to outdo them. They'd spend a year and a half, 2 years, and they bring him over and say, look, hey, come on, sit down. They start piling the stuff onto him. They didn't need this anything. That's just funny. They didn't need this stuff. They could probably work an hour or two a day at most and have everything they needed. They'd go out and just pick apples. And it was just easy to live. It was easy to get by. Why is that significant? because it's just another example of, you know, what are you going to do when you got everything you already need? What do you do next?
Give it away.
So why should you be ambitious when hopefully I've just proven that it's irrational and illogical and against your own DNA programming to be ambitious? You're supposed to be risk-averse, just do the least amount to get by, don't take any risk because you might die. Take the nice, safe middle roadway. You know, take your little muzzle and put it in the ass of the sheep in front of you and walk around in circles and enjoy the view. Why should you stand up and take chances and explore? What was with these guys who got on ships and started exploring like the Spanish Cortez and them guys? What was going on with them? What were they trying to do? Actually, you know what they were trying to do? Cortez was trying to gain title. He wanted to have prestige in his homeland. He wanted to bring a bunch of gold back so he could buy himself nobility because he had an ego problem. And he will go forth and conquer these lands and do all the, you know, everything he did, including, you know, major crimes against humanity for all practical purposes, all in the name of giving himself some kind of prestige and entitlement so he can have a little villa when he got back. That was it. He was going to give the money, but mainly goes to the queen. They were funding the thing. That's what he wanted. Ego. Ego aggrandizement. So why should you do anything? You need to redefine the word ambition. If you look at it, external motivation, you have to do a certain amount of things because you're externally coerced to do these, like you'll starve if you don't go out and do something. But after you do that, there's really nothing in you that says you should do more. Internal motivation, as we discussed in a previous session, is the difference for something I'm going to call conscious ambition. Instead of blindly being ambitious, blindly with no particular purpose in mind and some vague idea that you're going to be rich, powerful, or famous, which are all basically ego plays. They're all basically to prop up your ego. If you don't need an ego play, so this is the way it works for people who are consciously ambitious, and you have to have a higher purpose that you're trying to attain these goals to serve. Some people do it in the name of a religion or their favorite local cult, and they'll be inspired to do these great things, supposedly, to bring religion to the heathens or to conquer other people or to try to force their will on others, to convert them into something. Right? They have to be like us. We have to convert them. And so this higher cause becomes their drive now. Even though they don't need the money, they want to make more money so they can push it towards their cause. And there's all kinds of causes, environmentalists, there's religion, there's political. There's, you know, tons of those. And a lot of people will do that. They will then make extra efforts because they want to put their money in. They want to build some family empire, which is all ego, by the way. But, you know, maybe that's your goal. Maybe that's it. That's all it's going to take. That's why people will become ambitious, even if they realize they don't need it, which they do, by the way. Everybody knows they don't need it. They're overriding that check, that safety valve, that check and balance feature. Everything's telling them to take it easy now. You got what you need. Don't work anymore. It could be fear of the future, by the way, too. It could be fear, so you want to have savings. You want to put some, you know, something aside, like a squirrel putting nuts in a tree for the winter. You know what I mean? They want to have all these various accounts and savings and so they can die rich, you know, which works out pretty good. You're dead and everybody else gets your money. They probably won't have the compunctions you had against spending it either, by the way. Matter of fact, I can almost guarantee that if you didn't want to spend any of your money and you gave it, let someone else inherit it, they're going to look at you as a case study and they're going to do just the opposite and blow all your money for you. So the best thing to do is take all your money. It's just before you die and go to Vegas, have one last big party. Here's what stops you from success in sales. Your DNA is stopping it because it knows that what you're about to do is irrational and that you should just make do just enough to get by, and anything beyond that, it doesn't make any sense. Ambition is ridiculous, crazy. So for you to override that and become one of the top 1% in sales, you have to consciously override all that programming And the only practical way to do that is to have a higher level goal that you're now trying to achieve, as opposed to mere money and glory, and it won't sustain you. The ego thing is hard to sustain. Not that many people are that egomaniacal where being the number one guy or getting the awards is enough. Some people are like that. But most people, you know, they think, yeah, it's great, but that's not enough to keep me working long hours like that. Yes, I want security, but, you know, that's kind of an abstract thing. I mean, dying so far out there in the future somewhere is not to be that meaningful today when I'm supposed to work 12 hours. So what is that goal? Like I say, if you're just trying to get by, you can't even pay your rent, then you have the base goals driving you. But you're not even in a comfort zone yet. To break out of the comfort zone, you have to override your programming. You do that by supplanting a higher level goal, and that's what you need to define for yourself. Why exactly do I need to do this? What am I going to accomplish? What am I going to do with the money? Am I trying to buy myself an alternate future where I can work really hard for 5 years and then go travel Europe for 5 years? Well, if that's the case, then here's what you need to do. You need to go to a travel agency or at a bookstore. You need to buy books on those countries. You need to start learning the languages. You need to find out exactly what you're going to do. You need to plan it all out in detail. And I want you to visualize yourself being in Paris and sipping, you know, cappuccinos in the cafe or having a nice meal, and you're going around, touring around, you're on the train going through France or England or wherever you're going to be. You need to kind of make that real and immerse yourself in that goal. That's going to be it. You're going to make that happen. What will happen is that vision, that dream, will then suffuse down into your subconscious mind, which is where all the action's at. You're going to tell your subconscious that I want this to happen, therefore I'm going to work hard right now, but this is going to be real. And then all the natural switches that would normally get turned on when you start working past your comfort zone, you're going to override all those signals that your body's going to tell you. It's like, I want to lose weight. Oh, sure, okay. Let's say you're 50 pounds overweight. You want to lose weight. Your body is telling you to eat whatever the hell you can find and stuff it in your face just in case the food gets shut off one day. Because millions of years of evolution have told it that food is unpredictable. You never know when your next meal is going to get. And that's why people gorge. That's why we have feasts, quote unquote. You have to literally override everything your body is telling you and stop eating. And now your body thinks you're trying to starve it. So now it's going to reduce its burn rate. It's going to lower your metabolism so as to conserve fat because it doesn't see the food coming in. So the best way to diet is you have to eat reduce the density of the food, the calorie density per cubic centimeter or weight. Like tiramisu is like the nuclear bomb of diets. It'll kill you. It's got like 9,000 calories per cubic centimeter. Great stuff. You ever eat it? Cheesecake, other really high fat, high calorie desserts. Your body loves those. All those are great. By the time you can eat 5 of those before you even think you're full. It'll just slide right by. It'll go right past you. The next thing you know, I just ate 8,000 calories. So you have to eat low calorie density foods like lettuce and carrots and other kinds of, you know, high grain breads. So you feel full, so your body doesn't think it's being starved to death. And then it will still burn calories at a normal rate, but you reduce your caloric intake. And, of course, then you want to exercise so you can burn even more calories. And then that's how you lose weight. It takes a lot of discipline. You have to override your natural inclination. If you just relax and let your body take over, it will make you fat. Let's prove this. Let's see if this is correct or not. Look around you in America. How many people are overweight? Anybody?
I am.
Well, I know that.
35%.
It's a big number, and the reason being is that your genetic programming is doing what it does best. It's doing exactly the right thing by making you fat. But the problem is you don't live in a world where food is hard to get. You live in a world where food is never more than 5 feet from your face. And it's cheap. But most of it's crap. But it's there, and it's high calorie, high salt, high sugar. It's just like cigarettes were designed to be addictive. They actually manipulated the nicotine levels. They called them nicotine delivery devices, and they were. They actually designed a lot of foods, especially at McDonald's. If you ever watch Super Size Me, you know what I'm talking about, or Fast Food Nation. They actually engineer this food to be addictive, the fat contents, the salts and the sugars, the textures, everything about them. They have food scientists, quote-unquote, and psychologists design this stuff to make you addicted and to get you to eat more. When your genetic programming in that environment serves to your detriment, it makes you overweight because you listen to your body's programming. Your programming right now tells you to stop working. If you truly want to be in the top 1%, which is the vast majority of you, even though I know I'm talking to entrepreneurial people who are commission only, even the majority of you don't really want to get rich, don't really want to be a success. Not really. What you want to do is the minimum to get by. What you want to do is you're looking for easy money. You want easy money here? You want to get it, find some lucky job where you can get paid a lot of money for doing very little. That's the natural inclination for salespeople. The general public wouldn't even be in the same room as us. But even amongst commission-only salespeople, the majority, really what they're looking for is something for nothing, easy money, and they want to do the least to get by. They just want more money than they're worth, but they still want what everybody else wants, the bare minimum. They just want to get by. They'd be perfectly happy to make 50, 80 grand, 100 grand a year, even though they could have made 600 grand if they would have worked harder. They don't care. And the reason they don't care is they have no reason for the money, and they know it. They have no vision of where the money would be. So here's how you create a goal. First, you create a vacuum. Nature abhors a vacuum. In other words, if you create a vacuum, things tend to rush into it. All right? The reason you hear a thunder when a lightning strike happens is that the lightning superheats the air and expands it out, and when it crashes back into the vacuum, that's what makes the noise. You have to create a vacuum where your goal is. You want to make that like a vacuum within yourself. I need to have this five-year trip in Europe. I want this house. And it's usually better to have it be bigger than yourself. In the service of others, you can make a bigger goal. I want to have enough money so I can open up a teen shelter because I had a teen that ran away. And there was no good facilities nearby, and there wasn't trained psychologists. So I want to fund a teen shelter to help kids who are in those situations again. Now, that goal will never leave you because it's not about you. It's not an ego goal, rich and famous and powerful, which doesn't exist. I'll tell you how powerful you are. You're going to die like everybody else. By the time you're about 75 or 80, you're dead. You're worm food. There's your power for you. All the pharaohs died. All the presidents have died. All the kings and dictators all died, and you're going to die. So much for your power. You want to talk about fame? I can give you a huge list of actors that used to be famous in the 80s you don't hear about no more because they're not interesting anymore. So much for your fame. Okay? Rich, you can lose your money, and if you have it, so what? What does it gain you? How many meals can you eat a day? 3? You want to eat 10 meals just because you're worth more money? You want to eat 5 times more food? If you buy 30 cars, how many cars can you drive at once? That means you own 30 cars. You can't drive more than one. You can buy 9 houses. You can only live at one at a time. You don't need to own it. You can stay at the Four Seasons in Denver. You don't have to buy a house there. And on it goes. It just has very marginal utility going forward to own a lot of these things. But if you want to serve others, that goal actually is enduring because you're working at a higher level now. Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you're working more towards the self-actualization level of actualizing your highest purpose in life. And it's more like when you become selfless, you actually become bigger. You removed your ego from the equation, and you become larger for it. So that kind of a goal, like I said, a vacuum, the analogy of vacuum, something will rush in to fill it. When you create that goal in deep, you visualize it in deep detail. It almost like creates a vacuum within your subconscious mind that has to get filled up with the reality. I know this is kind of a rough analogy, but I hope you get the idea. When you're working those extra hours now, it's real easy to do so because you're doing so for this reason. Now, by the way, you can have blind faith in some religion or cult. And that may be a driving force for you, but inside you'll probably know that, you know, there's always this nagging little doubt that maybe your religion is not the one after all, that you're not, maybe it's just not true. Maybe you've been really talking yourself into it. Maybe that cult you joined, maybe that guy driving around the Rolls Royce and a great beard, nah, he's not all he crapped up to be. I don't know. I think for a lot of people, maybe some people will take that all the way. Some people might be a little bit weak for him. Something a little bit more specific where it's undeniably real. Like, again, let's say you want to create a fund to send kids to school who were disadvantaged and we give them an opportunity to go to college. That doesn't require any beliefs in any deities or supernatural. There's no debate about that being something in more of immediate cause. I'm just going to put this out there for this reason. That goal will actually work better. Most people, anyway, when it comes to religion, are superficial about it anyway. Yeah, they go to Sunday, and then they just forget about it, and they do whatever they want during the week anyway. To them, it's like an exercise. It's almost like an extortion racket where if they go to church, blah, blah, stick in some money, they get to go to heaven. If you ask them what they actually believe, they go, oh, I don't know. It's like what they're doing is they're hedging their bet. They're putting some money up there. It's like the mafia did in the old neighborhoods of New York. They go around, they collect protection money. You know what I mean? You don't know for a fact they're going to come over and break your legs, but why bother taking the risk, right? It's better to put a few bucks in the pot, and then they leave you alone. Now, so, you know, you get fire insurance, they call it. So, I mean, those goals are nice, but I don't think they won't sustain you. Unless you're that devout and focused, in which case, then you're at a different level than most people who say they're religious. For most people, religion is not a motivator. You need something more specific, something you can detail out. The net result of this is this. Your DNA tells you to stop. You can easily override it because you've created another need. But the need is based in reality. It's an actual need. And therefore, you can continue going forward. And the best way to do that, I'll posit here, is to have some kind of higher level goal in mind.